Welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where we are simplifying the good life. I'm Adele Dittus.
What did you do with Aaron Flores?
I put him in my pocket.
He's not going to like that. And I'm Brock Dittus, broadcasting for the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
We cover bicycles, trains, and transit, and simpler living, and today writing about thinking about writing while writing, about simplicity towards happiness. So this is David Howell. Hello, David. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good now.
Welcome back to Portland.
All right.
Yeah. You are the author of the Descent into Happiness.
Yes.
Which is a fantastic memoir about your bike tour that you did. Is that now 3 years ago?
No, this was a year ago.
A year ago?
Yeah.
So that came to the presses really quickly.
Yes.
All right, there we go. Fantastic book. I got a chance to read that after you sent us the hard copy. And Adele also read that, which is why she's here.
I did. I might have even finished it before you.
Yeah, Aaron is reading it, which is why he's not. No, I mean, Aaron has other engagements tonight, so he's out, sadly. But he will, of course, be back next week. But yes, we got you in to talk to you about your book. You're here moving your son into college.
Yeah.
So good for him. Good for you. And we are here. It's a warm, hot day. Adele, you and I were just at the park, trying not to fall asleep.
Yeah, you kind of like kept slipping into your sleep mode, like your breathing. I could hear it would change into,
and what is my sleep breathing
cadence
sound like?
It just gets a little bit louder. And it's kind of breathing through your mouth.
Okay, so I'm just like
so intimate.
Okay.
Yeah, a little bit like that. Yeah,
this is very
and
intimate.
So I thought you were sound asleep actually.
This is scintillating to all the people listening.
You've had a long day.
You know you're close to Brock when he goes. So yeah.
Yeah.
Does it sound like that?
No, it's not quite that bad.
Okay, all right. Well, anyways, no less than 25 times did I do the whole fall asleep, start a dream, wake up, like, oh, wait, I'm in the park, our bikes are unlocked.
Yeah.
Fall asleep, repeat.
So I'm glad we made it over here, David.
Yeah.
Because
so, David, you're more conscious.
In the park.
Way more conscious than we are right now.
You're going to get leg up on us.
Do you feel conscious?
I'm feeling good.
Oh, good. Excellent. well, you know, one thing I like to do when I'm falling asleep is go over to the Beer Mongers in Southeast Division and 12, because that's a shop that sells you tasty, tasty beverages that won't let your taste buds sleep. And they are our beverage sponsor, which you're enjoying one of your favorites over there, David. What do you have?
Dale's Pale Ale.
Yes. How did you introduce yourself to Dale's Pale, or how did it introduce itself to you?
I saw a very interesting looking guy in the grocery one day, a nice tats.
Mm-hmm.
Buying some Dale's.
Ah.
So I had to ask him, you know, what's that all about? And he had an Australian accent.
I'm like, and also, what's the beer?
Dale's Pale Ale.
Nice. Very good.
Which must have sounded really cool in an Australian accent with all those vowels.
I would try to mimic that, but I'm not cool enough. Yeah.
I don't do accents either, really. I have like three of them and they don't sound like anything.
I shouldn't try to do
that. But it's a great beer. I got introduced to Oscar Blues because they make the 10-50, which is a super thick stout. And that was the first time I'd ever had. It's called the 10-50 because it's 10.5%, I think, alcohol by volume, and that's very strong. So that I think that might have been the strongest thing I had had up until that point, or something.
Wait, and now you can find more offerings that are
that's true
10 or 11.
And there have always been malt liquors. So if you swing that direction, but if you want a good craft beverage,
I'm so glad you moved past your malt liquor phase.
Me too. Go to Dale's. Go to Dale's in the Beer Mongers at Southeast Division and 12th.
There's no malt liquor in the Beer Mongers, correct?
I mean, there are many malty beverages, but there is no malt liquor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
It's all classy. So, yeah, I'm a fan. Adele, welcome home. You just took a trip to...
I thought you meant to the garage.
Well,
that we're
welcome
in
home
right
to
now.
The garage, yes. We don't live here, but
this
welcome home.
This is my third
home.
Time on the podcast.
Welcome
did
home
I
to the mic. Welcome home to
weeks.
People's ears. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. It's good to be back. I was gone for 2 days, but it seemed like a lot longer.
Right.
Yeah.
So you went to the ocean by yourself. This
I
was
did.
An exercise in solitude, which we're going to be talking to David. We're going to talk about your book in just a little bit here. So tell us about your adventure.
Well, I decided to go out to the coast, and I've been out to the Oregon coast many times, but I've only taken two routes to get there over the 10 years I've been here. So I always go out, almost always go out Highway 6. And last summer I explored a little more roundabout, more beautiful way south of there through the mountains along the Nestucca River.
Yeah.
And this time I plotted a course that was at least 100 miles along the Nehalem River outside of Vernonia and up through kind of the forests and fields up there.
Yeah.
And it would spit me out at Nehalem Bay by Manzanita. And my goal was to do a double century.
So this is 100 miles out, 100 miles back.
Yeah. Thanks to, you know, those crazy people you had on after the Steens Mazama podcast. So
those
I listened
damn
to
bicyclists.
Them. Yeah. After
riding
listening to
distance.
David and Maria, I was just like, oh, man. I got to at least try a double century. They just did, you know, Maria did 10 centuries in a row and DVR was going for way more miles a day than that. So I just wanted to see how it felt.
Yeah.
Right? Because I've done a fair amount of centuries. But
what did you learn?
Well, I think the Pacific Crest Trail kind of set the bar. Like I'm in an unusually good amount of physical condition right now. So I learned that it actually wasn't that hard.
Okay.
I was not nearly as exhausted as I thought I would be.
Everybody should do it.
Everyone should do a double century. However, with a caveat that if I did this in January, I would be hurting.
Sure.
Because summer is usually when I can kind of up my game.
Summer is when our muscles are all fit and toned and ready to go.
Yeah. So I ended up...
As opposed to other times of year.
Other times, yeah. We're just kind of like flabby and hanging out. Watching
January,
lots
I'm very
of
good
Game
at drinking
Thrones.
Indoors. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, lots of Netflix binging. So I went out. I did 120 miles out. And camped at the Hiker Biker at Nehalem Bay.
Okay. Then, they have a cheap site for bicyclists there?
Yeah, $6.
Nice.
And it was kind of funny because I was really ready to talk to people by the time I rolled in because I had not talked to anyone all day.
Right.
And so I was imagining all these great conversations in my mind that I would have. Hey,
it's
where
be
are you
so
coming
good.
From? Oh, you're from New Zealand. Cool. Tell me about all your adventures.
I'm going to Death Valley.
Yeah, Death Valley. And so I rolled up and there were a bunch of bikes in the Hiker Biker. And there was one guy and I said, hey. And he said, I don't even know if he said a word in response. And then he just looked down at his feet.
He grunts and like shuffles.
He was just sitting at this picnic table. So I said, all right. Then so I took my camp stove and my food over to the beach and I hung out for a few hours, watched the sunset. And when I got back, I thought, hey, maybe people will be hanging out around the communal fire. I had my beer, but still nobody was there. So
solitude under protest.
I just tucked in, read some East of Eden. And then by about 10 o'clock, some people came back and were sort of talking amongst themselves. But by that time, I was done because I was planning to wake up at before 6 the next morning to get a good start on the way back.
And you have to ride 100 miles. So yeah.
It's funny because usually when I tour with you, we don't really want to talk to as many people because we have each other to talk to all day.
Right.
So we're almost talked out. But when you tour by yourself, it's a much different experience. I'm so eager to meet people. So
right.
That did not happen this time.
Uh-huh. David, do you have any experiences along that line? Because you tend to prefer solitude, as I understand from your writing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you cannot help but meet people.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, I have a rule in life. You know, if someone gives you a beer, you accept the beer.
Oh, that's a good rule.
Yeah.
It's a good rule.
Yeah. Because it's good to have a beer. It's good to have the conversation that comes with it.
Sure.
And that would tend to happen quite frequently on this trip.
Inebriation for the soul.
Yes.
Yeah. Have you ever been in the position where you wanted to see people and didn't see them?
No.
Okay. So you can't relate to Adele's story then.
you know, I was also fine being on my own, but I just thought it was funny that there was no one there to talk to me. Because usually people are trying to engage at these Hiker Bikers and I'm usually too tired to. So.
They're social places. Yeah, definitely. And there are varying times that we want different things. And yeah, this time you wanted to talk to people, but they weren't to be had.
Mm-hmm. Oh, can I tell you about the bridge?
I was going to ask about that because this is the other story that I was amused by.
So there's this bridge of mystery.
Yeah. And David, are you familiar with the geography of the Oregon coast here in the northwest corner, the Manila Tab of Oregon?
Slightly.
Okay.
Okay. So it's, you know, very rugged. And there's all these little roads that I was checking out on the map, just a state highway map before coming out, before making my trek. And I saw it was on the state highway map. It was in gray. So it was a very small road. And it wound its way down along the Nehalem River. It was called the Lower Nehalem Road. Lower Nehalem River Road. Mm-hmm. And I'd been following sort of the upper Nehalem just north of 26.
Yeah.
So then I got spit out onto Highway 26, which is the way to drive to the coast from Portland.
And the worst way to bike, right?
I've never biked it.
To cycle. It's a bicycle cycle.
Full of cars going very fast, logging trucks, RVs, everything. So this tiny little Lower Nehalem Road looked like it took me exactly where I wanted to, and I'd only have to go on 26 for about a mile. But I Googled it just to see if anyone had biked it, and there were sort of these rumors online about a bridge washing out in the big flood of 2008, mm-hmm. and these people were saying it's never been rebuilt, you can't go down it, you're going to get, you know, blocked maybe when you're only about 10 miles from the coast. So what a horrible scenario to bike, get right within 10 miles of the coast and then have to turn around.
And you can't ford this river or anything.
No. Well, no. I was looking at the Nehalem the whole time. I was biking along it in the morning thinking, could I swim across this with my bike?
Could I get my stuff across
no,
this?
No, this is not a creek. This is a river.
Okay.
So,
because you like fording creeks.
I do.
You're a fan.
If I didn't have my bike, I'd try and swim across it, but okay, not with my steel bicycle. So, so it was just really bothering me. Is this bridge out? I didn't want to risk it. I didn't bring water purifying stuff, so I wouldn't have wanted to rough it, you know, in the woods if I didn't make it.
Right.
And so I went down Highway 26 till I found a little coffee stand, and I ended up asking about seven locals who were buying their coffee as well as the barista.
No less than seven.
I said, hey, do you know anything about this bridge? Nope. We have no idea. Oh, we live in Nehalem a few miles away from where this bridge should be. We have no idea what you're talking about. We haven't been on the, what are you talking about? We don't go on that road.
No one uses that road.
So I was like, oh,
how should
right
we know if the bridge is there or
I
not?
I even called the state, the county highway patrol, the classic uh-huh county number. And the lady there was just like, I have no idea.
I could give you Eddie's number.
Yeah.
Eddie might know.
Getting Eddie's number. So I have to call Eddie. He's the head of recreation for the Tillamook State Forest or something like that. So I'm going to call him. I'm going to ask
the head of recreation. The people that are in charge of the roads don't know if their bridges are working.
Yeah, they have no
okay
idea.
So, yeah.
So I was baffled and a little bit just not happy with the situation. So just to be on the safe side, I ended up biking along 26 for about 14 miles.
Yeah.
And then I did get on this very small little highway that got me to Nehalem,
right,
which ended up to be a lovely ride. But the 14 miles on Highway 26 were probably some of the worst riding I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
It was pretty bad.
David, can you think of the worst miles you've ever ridden in your life?
Yeah, well, on this trip last summer,
uh-huh,
it was in eastern Montana on Highway 2.
Ooh.
So double rumble strip, semis, logging trucks, every worst possible scenario all
yeah
thrown together at once.
Did you have a little bit of a shoulder to work with?
Just a little bit of shoulder.
Like a couple, like enough for your tires?
Yeah, and enough to know to stop whenever I saw something big coming in the mirror.
Wow.
Okay.
And then, you know, a funeral procession, which was a terrible order. Yeah.
No.
It's like, okay.
I mean, funerals aren't funny, but yes, it's yeah like, yeah.
It's like, this is great. They're going really slow,
right,
but
past
I don't
you
need to see.
You're already thinking about death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll be safest when I follow this hearse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was good to get off the road.
Yeah. You know, I don't have a rear view mirror on my bike. And yesterday, 2 days ago was one of those situations where I really wished I'd had one, just so I could see when those like logging trucks were going to come by.
And we've talked about getting mirrors for years now because it seems really utilitarian. And I don't care if they look like dumb or something.
I mean, they
don't look dumb, but I don't care if somebody thinks that they
squares, but now I think they're
right. Well, I mean, it's nice to know what's coming behind you without having to crane your neck around and possibly lose your balance. You're like, I always swerve to the left when I looked at my, behind me because that's the direction I'm looking. And
they're
so, yeah,
a really good idea.
Right.
I was going to ask, how long did it take you to kind of, well, realize you wanted one?
Well, I have mixed feelings. I think they're a bad metaphor because I don't want to look backward.
Mm-hmm.
But never look behind.
Yeah.
But sometimes, no regrets.
Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't hurt. So I had a mirror that you could easily just, you know, flip away. You wouldn't have to use it. And then you could flip it back so that you could use it on the end of my handlebar.
Oh, yeah. Mm. So not mounted to your head.
Nice. Correct. Yeah.
There you go.
And I tried the helmet mounted mirror, and I was always looking at it.
Uh-huh.
I was obsessed with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it was good to let that go.
It's like an iPhone mounted to your glasses or something.
Yeah. And, you know, and you can kind of get a glimpse out of the periphery if there's something coming up behind you.
Uh-huh.
So.
Okay. Yeah. There we go. But you found them to be incredibly useful.
Yes.
Because I've heard that from a lot of people in rural contexts. It's like, especially if it's a noisy highway situation and you can't always be looking around behind you. And yeah, it seems like it's good to have more information is a good thing.
But you know, the first thing I did when I finished my trip was take that mirror off.
So you don't use it for riding around your town, your home.
No.
Okay.
But you know, I really try to do bike paths as much as I can.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah. Do you have some good bike path networks?
Yeah, Milwaukee's catching up, yeah.
Cool.
Right, cuz Minneapolis is the capital of bike paths apparently. That's what I've heard.
The whole state of Minnesota.
Yeah, and Portland holds a grudge against Minneapolis for temporarily stealing our title. I think that whole thing is dumb cuz it's like if you like riding your bike, you're going to ride it no matter what and you're going to make your communities good places to ride in. But I've heard great things about the bike paths there, and I would love to experience that. But Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but I think through Minnesota and Wisconsin, I was all on path.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was a real pleasure because I could stop worrying about the traffic and spend more time thinking about stuff.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Right. And your trip was all about thinking about stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the purpose.
So unpack the, first of all, tell us about the book because everything that we're talking about probably is going to come out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, The Descent into Happiness by Blue Ear Books. Initially I was going to just do this bike ride and write a series of essays for some courses I teach at the university that I teach at.
Did we mention you're a doctor?
Not yet.
We should.
Not yet.
Not a medical doctor. Yeah. But,
a
mental doctor.
A doctor
That's
of
right.
thoughts.
Doctor of philosophy.
There we go.
I really just wanted to have some time to solve some problems of scale. And one of the courses I teach is creative thinking. And we leverage, there's this guy Dugan who has a book on strategic intuition. And basically it's just a methodology for having epiphanies. And I had been struggling with a problem of scale ever since I'd been married because I love my wife to death. I love spending time with her, but I love to be alone. I'm a hardcore, self-proclaimed introvert.
This is a fascinating dichotomy.
Yeah.
And you get into that in detail, which is kind of cool. One of the things I like about your book, by the way, is that it's really easy to write a travelogue. And it's really easy to complain about the bed and breakfast that you stayed at and how like the pancakes weren't that great. But it's really hard to find someone who writes about a story. I don't know if you're a fan of Michael Crichton or not, but Michael Crichton was good at layering like a story with a theory, and the two things weren't necessarily related. But you know, like Jurassic Park was dinosaurs and chaos theory, and he like takes those two things and like mashes them together. And your book kind of does something like that, where it's like, this is a story about an experience, and it's also a thought exercise about kind of what is it like to think and what is it like to spend time alone and that sort of thing. So I appreciated that because it's like, again, it's really easy to find travelogues. It's not that easy to find really good writing that involves a bike tour. So,
well, and I think that's something that a lot of cyclists enjoy is the thought process that goes with it.
Yeah.
So what surprised me when I was looking for information on the thought process of cycling is, you know, how hard it was to find that or to not be able to find it.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard of any writings on that so far.
For sure. But I think some of our friends delve into some of that, like Tom Allen, who wrote Janipar, great book about bicycle touring. Brian Benson's Going Somewhere.
And there were things that I read for when I was doing my Montessori teacher training, the book Flow, which I think you actually quote in your book. And the author talks about that being in the moment, that feeling of satisfaction where you're doing something that's like just challenging enough that you sort of lose this concept of time and you're in that flow. So I could like, I've picked up on writings that feed into a good description of my mental state when I bike, but I really like that you addressed it right on. So how did you get the idea for a bike tour to sort of solve, to work out this problem of scale for yourself?
Well, I was talking to a friend, Ethan Casey, who does Blue Ear Books. And we were just having a beer in Milwaukee. He happened to be in town. And I said, well, I'm thinking about writing these essays. And he suggested turning it into a travel narrative because he knew I was going to be doing this bike ride. The cycling would be a vehicle for writing. Which it was, and it was just nothing but fun in that regard. So I'd be cycling along, and if I had an idea, I could just pull over, lean my bike against a signpost, take out the laptop, and just start riding away.
Right.
Which ended up being a bit of a paradox in that people would pull over and ask me, what are you doing? And then I'd have to stop writing and explain to them that I was writing, and then have a long conversation, which ended up with, you know, beer and dinner, which meant I was not writing.
Is it the observer effect?
when you look at something,
you change it.
Yeah.
Oh, how funny. So you're sort of losing your concentration in a way when people are pulling up, but you get to, that's kind of a hard choice to make. Did you ever regret that people invited you over?
Because that's what I ended up writing more about.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that was another problem that I realized on the trip, was that I wasn't really a big fan of humanity when the trip began. You know, a bit of a jaded human being.
Is that because of your studies of philosophy or interactions at a college?
maybe a little bit of both.
But just going to the grocery store.
but philosophers, you know, they're not really positive when it comes to the human condition.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I'm very positive when I leave for a bike tour either. I don't want to talk to anybody.
Yeah.
But boy, you know, you go out in places like Idaho, North Dakota, Minnesota, and you meet people who are just very genuine, and they're willing to share their lives with you and their food and their conversations in their backyards for your tent, or the whole warm shower network, which was a great resource.
Yeah. Reciprocal touring, hospitality.
Yeah. So by the end, you know, the dichotomy of wanting to be alone and wanting to be with my wife, I think, was really impacted by all of these very good people who I met along the way.
Wanting to be alone and then meeting awesome strangers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in the end, I realized, you know, solitude is good for interacting with people, and interacting with people is good for solitude. So they don't have to be mutually exclusive.
Yeah. To define, anybody who's not aware, read me, problem of scale. I forget the definition of that, because it's not just a problem. It's not your weight.
Yeah. So with Dugan, you know, so the larger the problem you want to solve, the more time and the more research you have to engage in.
Ah, okay.
So let's say you have a big problem and you have to do a lot of reading or a lot of networking or conversation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can never solve the problem in the laboratory.
It's going to take some time to figure out.
Yeah. So that's why all the great problems people have solved have happened while they're on vacation.
Gotcha.
So you get out of the laboratory, you kind of let the brain do what it's designed to do, which is connect various pieces across your neural network.
Uh-huh.
And that happens when we're chill and relaxed.
Right. So you had to relax for a good deal of time in order to work these things out.
Yeah. So people who never take vacation, I think, are missing out on the opportunity of having large ideas.
Right. And as I recall, your setting was something, you'd stop me if I'm giving away too much of your story.
Yeah.
Because I know you got to sell the book too.
But, I know, don't give away the ending. No.
But it seems like you were in a position where for a while you were kind of locked down to a schedule. You didn't have time to relax.
Yeah.
And you found problems with that.
Well, yeah, because I just fell in love with cycling. So like doing centuries day after day became obsessive because there's great pleasure or great happiness, I should say, in that kind of work.
Right. So you describe yourself as an introvert. Is the pleasure of the century, is that just like a self-satisfaction? Like, hey, I did 100 miles. I did it again. Or is it like I did it and I was better than this guy who got this time? Or
well, So once again, I think the relationship between the physical activity of biking that much and the mental activity really overlapped.
Yeah.
So, you know, the first, like, you know, you go through the Cascades, the Northern Cascades or Idaho or the Rockies, you meet a lot of other people because a lot of other people are enjoying that topography.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody wants to bike across the Midwest.
Amen.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people would take the train back, or they'd throw their bikes in the back of a U-Haul and head down to Wyoming. They go where the mountains are.
Right.
Sure. That's exactly what we did.
Well, yeah, we rode to Colorado and then we said, you know, screw the plains. We're turning around and we're going to see more of Colorado. So
but there's something in it different for you.
Yeah. So it enabled me to get deeper into my thought process, because the landscape of the Great Plains is beautiful. Yes. But not nearly as distracting.
Right. Mm. And so, you want to get into the landscape of the brain or of the mind.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And how much of your thought, I think you talk about this in the book, but people who bike long distances, like I always struggle with this, the amount of thinking effort I'm putting towards, I'm so tired, I'm in pain, when is my destination, when do I get to eat food? And then the thought process that I wish I could go with, which is sort of just letting maybe issues in my subconscious bubble up and maybe work through them. So like, do you have a strategy for, I don't know, maybe like opening your mind to the possibilities of problem solving, or do you just sort of let it happen naturally?
Well, my favorite philosopher is this guy Nishida Kataro, like the founding father of the Kyoto school. So like 20th century Zen Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes a lot about pure experience. So it's kind of like flow theory, but I really like the Buddhist flavor in pure experience. Mm-hmm. And he'll write, like other Buddhists, he'll write about the difference between thinking, non-thought, and not thinking. So, you know, thinking is when our brain is active. Right now, the three of us are having a great conversation. My brain's just firing. I'm really enjoying it. And not thinking is when, like, I'm watching a rerun of Family Guy at the end of the day because I'm shot from thinking all day.
I've seen this before. I don't need to think about it now.
Yeah. So, but non-thought is this happy in-between where you're very mentally active, but you're not focused on anything in particular. And I can, in my day-to-day life, I can enjoy that for periods of time, but not for hours at a time. And that's where I think the bike tour really became an opportunity.
So you found a way to slip into a non-thought state and
yes.
kind of remain there.
Yeah. So, yeah. And getting back to the whole idea of neural psychology and information moving from the frontal lobes where your short-term memory kind of runs in a spin cycle mm-hmm. to long-term in the cerebellum. You know, that all of that connectivity really requires some space and some method, some repetition. So,
right.
You know, I'm in the saddle. I'm alone. I have about 9 hours to cross some desolate part of North Dakota. That's a great opportunity to engage in some rich thought.
Sure.
Right. And the repetition, does that come just kind of from spinning your pedals and sort of almost being like trapped on this bike?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You bet. Yeah. What else are you going to do?
Right. Because I suppose some people would think, well, why don't I just sit on a cushion in my house and try and sort of meditate for hours and get the same effect, which maybe you could do.
Sure.
I don't have the self-discipline to do that, which I think is why I love biking really far, because it gives my mind space to open up like that.
Well, and this guy Nishida, I mean, that's really what pure experience is. It's meditation in motion. So, I mean, he was a master of Zazen or sitting meditation, but he really takes it to, you know, every aspect of one's life. So yeah, the bicycle for me is the sitting pillow, if you will, but it's very physical. And there's a lot of great research coming out right now on how, you know, physical activity is great for thought process.
Sure.
So, but if I'm alone in the saddle for days at a time, and I have a large problem to solve, and I've mm-hmm. done all my research on the front end, so the data's in my brain. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of letting the brain put the pieces together. And mm-hmm. then all of a sudden, you have an epiphany or a realization.
And this is kind of the apex of non-thought?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a cool strategy.
Is it like a bread machine of the mind?
Yeah.
Where you take all these different pieces and you put them in there, and thinking is getting the pieces in there, I suppose. But then you have to mix them up.
Well, and I don't think it was the intent of Nishida or any Zen Buddhist to use this as a problem-solving strategy.
Sure.
I just think that, you know, I mean, I teach people how to think. I have to teach students how to solve problems of scale because that's what they're going to get paid to do someday. So I tell them, yeah, work really hard and then take some frickin' vacation so that your brain can have the other
that's
half
so
of the
good.
Experience.
Well,
right.
That's so good. And it's such a good message for our culture to hear, because we're so go, go, go and work focused that just that idea of, okay, you do have to put in some work up front, do your research, put some thoughts in your head, but then take a step back and just allow things to happen almost without trying, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and I saw this play out. Before I went into the university to teach, I worked at Microsoft for a while. And the smartest people at Microsoft, when I worked there in the 90s, were the people who were staring out the window. And, you know, they were the ones that were really coming up with the big ideas. And it always amazed me that they were doing most of the front-end research, and they were spending most of the time just kind of sitting in their office, like that TV show House.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I love that show because every single episode he has an epiphany.
And he's just kind of sitting there tapping his cane on the ground, chewing pain pills, and suddenly he's, I know what's wrong with it. Get out of the way. I'll fix it.
Yeah. So, but he allows himself to do something other than work in the hospital.
Sure. And maybe that's the thing. Like, you need a change of setting or a change of context for your brain to work sometimes.
Yeah. So, and that's why I worry in this age of information, you know, I mean, I got a smartphone in my pocket and it's my nemesis because I know how quickly I can turn to it for a constant data stream.
Right.
But it doesn't solve problems.
No. Yeah. Right. The brain does that.
Right. And that's the crucial difference.
Yeah. As far as, well, I'm just thinking about the phones and do you use any strategy to keep your phone from dragging you down?
Yeah. Yeah. This is a long conversation that I've had with my wife and my daughter, cause I had phone addiction for years and it got to the point where my wife, who was calling my name, but I couldn't hear her even though she was sitting right next to me because I was deep in my phone.
Right.
Right. I mean, she said, you know, this is a problem.
Uh-huh.
So I had to realize I need to solve this problem.
Right.
So my daughter had a flip phone. So I did the unthinkable. I went to Verizon. I turned in my beautiful iPhone.
Oh my God.
For a Verizon flip phone.
How could you do such a thing?
Unthinkable. Yeah, unbelievable.
How weird is that?
They must have thought you were crazy.
Yeah.
But don't you need the internet all the time? Know?
All the time.
That's what
your daughter, does she still operate with a flip phone?
Yeah. That's and she was cool. So disappointed in me when I recently went back to a smartphone.
Oh.
Yeah. But you know, I went back to the smartphone because I was driving through Denver after doing the triple bypass.
Ah.
You know, three mountain passes in one day. I was exhausted.
Not a surgical operation.
No. trying to use printouts of Google Maps, you know, to find the hotel. And I was a wreck.
Yeah.
I just wanted to hear the sweet voice of Siri telling me exactly how to get to the hotel.
Turn left
now.
Such
a beautiful thing.
You've worked hard. You deserve this.
Yeah. Good job.
So I thought, well, let's see if I can go back to the phone without the addiction.
There you go.
So far, so good.
Oh, nice. Oh, congratulations.
Your daughter's pretty revolutionary for, you know, this generation.
And,
right.
And angry at me for going to my phone.
Well, that's such an interesting, like, you got to be pretty countercultural to not have one these days. So it's interesting. But I've tried to neuter mine as much as I can to try and kind of take all the bite out of it so that it doesn't it's not super distracting unless I want it to be.
It's not shouting at you all the time.
Right, right. I don't mind if I want it to shout at me, I can tell it to, but it doesn't have to.
Well, and it was a big part of this trip too, because I know that if I had a smartphone, I would rely on it for things I shouldn't have.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, like using the adventure cycling maps.
Yeah.
That was great.
Like hard copy maps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had adventures that I would not have had otherwise because the maps were out of date or I forgot to check for the updates on their website.
I was going to say.
Because I didn't have my smartphone.
What did you bump into along those lines?
Well, like I'm in the middle of, once again, North Dakota, and I see on the map that there's going to be a town up ahead. So I got, you know, three 24-ounce bottles of water, and I'm rationing the water, and I finally get to this town, and there's no town.
Ooh.
It was just three
bars
that had obviously closed a while ago.
Uh-huh.
And that happens.
Happens a lot, yeah.
More often than you'd think out there, but it's just so hard to know what to trust.
It turns out it's really hard to keep a bar open in small-town America, really.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no tap beer.
Yeah.
So I had to, you know, deal with it.
And what did you do?
Well, I was thirsty.
Yeah.
And I talked to the deities saying, well, okay, universe, I'm obviously in need of some water.
I'm open.
Yeah. And maybe 10 miles later, an RV passed me and stopped. And a petite Japanese woman got out and handed me a bottle of bottled water.
Uh-huh.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And that happened again and again and again on this trip. Serendipity was a big part of the experience.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people who bicycle tour talk about how kind of it opens your eyes or reopens your eyes to both the goodness that exists in the world that we don't necessarily think is there and being impressed by generosity. So,
yeah. And I think bike touring, it's, you want to set out prepared, but when you do need something, that's when you open yourself up to the kindness of other people. When you're kind of vulnerable in that way and you don't have all your shit together, basically.
Right.
Like, or the map is wrong. Yeah.
Huh. Tell me about, I remember you challenged yourself to not push your limits, or you were pushing one of your limits by not going fast. You intentionally wanted to roll slowly.
Yeah. So I have, well, one of the other classes I teach at the university is ethics. And one thing that we talk about is how we really don't have rules that we follow that determine our conduct.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'll ask my students, you know, okay, we behave in a certain way every day of our lives. What are the rules that you follow? And they're always stuck. You know, they'll eventually come up with the golden rule, you know, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And I'm like, okay, well, on a daily basis, how often do you turn to those rules?
Right.
And of course, you know, nothing. They don't use that. So an assignment that I have them do is to write out a list of rules that they can follow so that they can then conduct themselves appropriately, whatever they consider that to be.
Uh-huh.
So the first time we did this, we tried doing it in class. Everyone's excited, but it didn't go anywhere because it's extremely hard to do. So I said, well, okay, I'll do it first. So I grabbed a piece of chalk and I wrote five rules down. And one of them was go slow. Because at that point in my life, it was kind of a yes man phase. The Jim Carrey movie had come out.
Right. Learn how to play guitar, talk a guy off a ledge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this could be an interesting social experiment. So I was saying yes to everything, and it was nothing but fun. I met a lot of people I would not have met otherwise, had a lot of great experiences. But as an introvert, it was killing me.
Exhausting. Knowing yourself. Yeah, you were just like, just burnt.
Yeah.
That's always sounded so tiring to me as a fellow introvert.
And I was doing, I was really into Ironman triathlon. So I had done maybe five or six of those, and I was kind of physically spent.
Yeah. Mm.
So slowing down on the bike instead of going as fast as I could was a good transition. And of course, you know, a solo self-supported tour was a great vehicle because once you put 50 pounds on your steel frame Salsa touring bike, you're not going to go fast.
Yeah, seriously. You're not on your tri bike. You're not just cruising. Yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing carbon fiber about a touring bike.
Was that frustrating for you at all to slow down, or was it good at first?
Yeah, it was. Well, you know, the first 5 or 6 days were through the North Cascades. I was going over mountains. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. So going slow uphill really made me happy. And, you know, Nishida distinguishes happiness from pleasure by saying that we suffer for what makes us happy. So the things that make me happiest in life, you know, my wife, my kids, my job, I suffer for these things.
You hear that, kids?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amen. So, and I love them.
That's real.
Yeah. And I love them, but, you know, you pay a price for parenting.
Right.
And so, yeah, going uphill, you know, lots of pain, lots of suffering, but I was so happy.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you reach the top of the mountain, you get to go down, which is nothing but pleasure.
Right. Mm.
So hence the title of the book, you know, I'm descending into happiness because the descent means I get to climb again.
There we go.
So if I can repurpose that idea in life, then either things make me happy or they give me pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that type of a metaphysical construct.
Sure. Mm. Yeah. Do you think you need both then, or are you trying to avoid one and find the other?
No, I think they have to once again balance each other out.
Okay.
So yeah. Like my wife is really into a yin yang concept, and I like that sense of balance.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and I had spent years of my life working too hard, and you can have too much happiness from all that hard work. You have to have the pleasure. And, you know, that pleasure might mean taking a break once in a while and going on vacation.
Going on a bike tour, for example.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is that brings you some sort of pleasure. Yeah.
Which overlaps with the premise of this book. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, being happy, having pleasure, it all works together freakishly well.
Yeah. Back to the concept of going slow, because I do remember that from your book, and it really struck me. Did you let that priority play out in other ways in your life besides the bike touring?
Yeah, the tour was a great lesson about slow. Mm. So, and I think doing, you know, the trip took about 35 days. So having that be part of a daily experience for that amount of time meant that I could transition it into life in Milwaukee once the trip had ended. But it did take a lot of a willingness to slow things down. Because, you know, you get back into the rhythm of your regular life.
Sure.
It's hard. Yeah. I've had that too. I can connect coming off of a, you know, big trip, and I'm immersed in nature and plodding along a trail, and then I get back into the city and immediately my life kind of clicks back into this quick routine. And so I'm trying to maybe more aggressively, I want to aggressively think about how to slow it down.
Yeah.
So were you able to do that at all in your daily life when you returned?
Yeah. Well, so once again, it's one of my five rules. And I keep a little laminated card in my wallet that has the five rules on it. So I can, you know, turn to that laminated card if I need to make a big decision. And it just really kind of simplifies things if I follow these five rules. So yeah, so slowing things down, that's just a really good rule to follow, I think, if I'm going to live the life that I choose to live.
Yeah.
So like, for example, I've been benefiting from free cable for maybe 5 years now. Ooh. And now Time Warner is requiring you to use this little box, I think, to prevent people from me from getting free cable.
Ah.
So I can't get the free box because I'd have to own up to Time Warner that I get free cable. So now,
wait, is this like, it's just like you found like an open jack in the house somewhere? You're like, I wonder if there's cable in here.
Yeah, well,
you don't have to give away all your secrets.
How does this work?
Well, no, so years ago, I wanted to watch the Tour de France.
Oh, sure.
So I had cable for 1 month.
Yeah.
And I asked the guy, hey, okay, it's time to, you know, disconnect the cable.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was kind of a lot of work to get up the ladder into the tree with
like,
all the squirrels.
Oh, screw it. I don't need to.
What else is a cable guy supposed to do?
He's not gonna watch more TV, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I just
fast forward 5 years later.
Yeah, exactly. So the decision not to, you know, pay the man for cable, in spite of the fact that I spent too much time, you know, watching cable TV when I should be reading books or staring out the window and having a good cup of coffee or conversation with somebody else or just being alone. So that decision kind of feeds the idea of slow because, you know, cable TV is not thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's when I am watching Rick and Morty at 2 o'clock in the morning or Robot Chicken because I can't sleep. I'm a bit of a insomniac.
Oh, sure.
And I can only stare at the ceiling for so long.
Then you have to stare at like something on a screen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I should be doing is going down, reading something else or, you know, doing something other than just feeding into the cable, which really stimulates my brain a little too much.
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. So, it's like, what is it? It's not thinking, but it's stimulating.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, it's just a constant reminder to slow.
Sure.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. After reading your book, I thought about that a lot. And I was really inspired by how you wrote your five priorities down on a card. I thought, I've never heard of anyone doing that before. I guess I didn't take any ethics classes in college. I was like, damn it, I should have taken that ethics
You're completely
course.
Unethical.
But I think that's just such a good message for people to sit and think about what they want to guide their life and what would be healthiest.
Yeah, because ethics is really all about conduct. And I think people miss out on that. So like riding the bike is great because it's all about riding the bike. But I think people get like when I was into triathlon, people were so fixated on the ideas rather than on the experience.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. How fast are my splits?
Look at the numbers, look at the data.
Just numbers.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the best thing I could do was take the clock off my bike. And then I realized, oh my God, I'm riding a bicycle.
It feels great.
It feels great.
Look at the trees.
Yeah. Right.
Look at the river.
No, that's huge. Because I feel like, there's a lot of cycling podcasts out there on the internet, and a lot of them are people talking about, like, how many watts they generated or whatever, and I wonder if there are anything, is there anything happening outside of that bike computer? And maybe there's not, but it seems like there's so much value in letting that experience in, so, yeah. I like this idea. This is a good line of thought.
Yeah.
Ethics are, it seems to me... and you tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like ethics are self-made. Like people have to come up with their own.
Yeah.
You can't give somebody else a package of ethics.
Well, and I think people do that all the time, right?
Uh-huh. Well, it's easier to have someone else. Well, this is what you should do.
Yeah.
But it seems like a big piece of the ethical thing is working it out for yourself and saying, well, what are my values and what do I want? I think when we started doing the podcast, that was one of the, I wanted to have conversations about some of these ethical things like, how do we think about phones and bikes and whatnot? And it's not about whether you're doing it wrong or not, but it's definitely about have you thought it out? Do you have a reasoned way that you've approached all of this? So,
well, and when I teach in the classroom, I think that's a real it's an issue that my students have. You know, am I supposed to hand them information that they memorize, or am I supposed to help them solve the problem themselves? You know, it's what is learning. And I think that a lot of my students believe learning is memorizing facts.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that learning is what you remember a year after you receive the information. So I challenge my students by asking them what they remember from a year ago. And I'll make them write it down. You know, last August, what do you remember from last August, 2015? and they'll write it down. I'm like, okay, that's what you learned from last August. And they'll have to kind of think about that.
I don't remember what I learned last August.
Did you learn anything?
I guess not.
You don't were teaching anybody. Other people how right. to drive buses.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
you
there we
go.
You
learned how to teach.
Right.
But, yeah.
No, it's interesting. Just that, yeah, that really is like what stuck, what
yeah.
sunk in.
Well, and I watched, my wife is a veterinarian, so I watched her go through vet school, and there's no way you can remember all that stuff about dogs and cats and pigs and birds. I mean, you can't.
Especially pigs mm-hmm. and birds.
Yeah.
They don't come in as often.
They're crazy the yeah. way they're made inside.
Keep your reference on hand.
So
the
I,
books are for
so it. She taught me that it's really about accessing the information. You know, where do you go for the information?
Yeah.
How do you keep current on the new information that's coming at you?
iPhones,
yeah.
Just kidding. Unless it works for you, unless yeah. you use it well.
But, you know, there's only so much room, right, in your long-term memory.
Yeah.
So how do we manage that information? What is the information that we want to tap into on a regular basis? And the rest of it, you know, how can we easily access it without necessarily having to have it hardwired into one's brain?
I'm just thinking it's too bad people have to wait till college to hear this because it's so crucial to how you do acquire information and learn.
If only
so
there
it's
was
super
some,
cool that
yeah.
people are taking your class. And then I'm thinking, oh, if only people could have that in third grade. Too.
If only there were options besides like the main educational system.
Oh, well, you're talking to... I'm a Montessori
to an alternative
teacher.
Education teacher, yes.
So I can connect with a lot of what you're saying in terms yeah. of education is not just about cramming your head full of facts. It's about problem solving. It's about discipline and willpower and like what your choices are and how you can follow through on those choices.
Yeah. And yeah. neuropsychology is becoming a bit more of a flavor of the day in the university setting because it seems painfully obvious that we should teach students how their brain works if they're going to be using it, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours a day. But we're not doing that in any structured way whatsoever.
Depends on how much not thinking they're doing, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm curious, just as far as a big piece of kind of you working out some things was you like your time alone, you like the time with your wife. Those two could be at odds with each other unless you work some things out. Did you work some things out?
Yeah, my son left to go for college, and now we're going to have an empty nest. And we get to spend time together, and I
Hopefully
get to spend time alone.
Oh, okay. So now that there's just more time,
it's easier.
Resolved, it's easier.
It's easier. But yeah. So when there is one's busy life, I think it just takes more discipline.
Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, I crave solitude, so I have to schedule it into my Outlook calendar.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be hours out of the day when I will not come in contact with other people.
Like non-office hours.
Yeah. And so that's where the flip phone was a great tool to learn from.
Sure.
Or like the hard thing about having students write on a computer, on a laptop, is that it opens other applications, like a web browser.
Yeah. So, have you heard of, I forget what they call it now, there was a thing called the Hemingwrite that it was like a Kickstarter project a couple of years back. And it was this... it was basically an electric typewriter. It was like
yeah.
you type into it, and the selling point was it doesn't have any apps. Yeah. It wouldn't distract you. All it would do is save your work.
Yeah.
So,
if we had the discipline to only use a word processor when we use our computer.
Sure.
But I don't know many people who can do that.
Right. Unless you buy an application that will like lock you out of all your other stuff for a
yeah.
certain amount of time so you can get stuff done.
This is just getting so multi-layered.
Right, right, right. Or you could use like a pen and paper and go in the woods somewhere, I guess. But I just remember the whole thing was like, hey, if you want to buy a machine that will allow you to type electronically without distraction, that's this.
Well, and that was the beauty, too, of this bike ride. I mean, you cannot go out into the Midwest and get a Wi-Fi connection.
It's not Wi-Fi everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're forced to just be in the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the computer worked as a word processor. That was it. Maybe I'd go in a small town. Maybe I would find some Wi-Fi so I could email some photos to friends and family telling them I'm still alive. I'm still out here
right.
having a good time. But then I'd get out of that town. And if I did have something I needed to write down, the computer was not competing against the word processor.
Sure.
So this is a little off topic, but is the bicycle for you solely a way to kind of like gain that solitude, or is it also a social tool, or do you have a lot of different bikes. So do you have like sort of a different bike for different frames of mind.
Yeah. So I just don't like riding my bike with people. I mean, I love...
Okay, so you really like to ride by yourself.
Yeah. So my wife, I love riding my bike with my wife.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
So, sounds great.
Yeah. So, and we'll go on an hour and a half loop together.
And I'm sure she loves riding her bike with you.
but even then, right? You know, most of the time, I'm just following her wheel and we're having a good time together.
Okay.
But we're not really wrapped up in conversation.
It's hard.
It's hard.
It's really hard. When we tour together, we really don't talk when we bike.
You end up like shouting at each other.
Yeah. It's more trouble than it's worth.
Did you see that thing back there? Yeah. That was cool.
What? Yeah.
You don't like it. It's cool. That's all right. I liked it. I thought it was cool. Yeah.
So, but, you know, but ironically, when my kids were growing up and we had a tandem or they're on the trailer bike, that's when they would really kind of open up. I don't know why that happens. But I learned more about my kids riding bikes because they would kind of launch into some monologue that they would not have told me within the parameters of our home.
You know, I heard something interesting. I was listening to On Being podcast and it was on running. And this guy was saying he has had some of the most open, vulnerable, best conversations with friends while running. And he was saying maybe it's something about not having to maintain total eye contact with the person. Like you can kind of open up more if you're not just sitting across the table from them and like honed in. Although that can be good too. But just, I don't know, there's something about, I've had this like running with people where, yeah, you can just kind of like talk and talk and talk, but you're also moving and you're not just staring at them. So yeah, there's something about that. And it's different than riding with someone else like your wife because the kids in the trailer, they're closer to you. So you can hear them.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty cool though. That's like a tool for connecting.
Yeah.
Connecting in that way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that is some of the best, I think. Well, it depends on if you like riding with people or not. You have to like the people you're riding with. But given that's the case, then it's a great time to connect and kind of swap thoughts and the thoughts that wouldn't come up maybe unless you had this time with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But to answer your question, I love to ride alone.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And even if it's just a commute to work and the commute home, I mean, that's 2 half-hour periods when I'm not with anyone else. And it's great for the transition from one environment to the other. Mm-hmm. And it's a real mental refresh. Mm-hmm. So when I walk through the door, I'm ready to engage in my family. Or when I walk into my office at work, you know, give me some students to interact with because I just had this great half hour of a non-thought experience when I was able to simply be with a bike.
Yeah. I'm interested in maybe how that thought plays with podcasts because I usually listen to something. I have like one earbud in my right ear when I'm writing to keep me distracted, I guess, because my commute's always been longer, about an hour or so. And I remember an hour without anything to listen to for me was always, it seemed like drudgery. I was like, oh, I can't, I'm so bored. Maybe I wasn't doing enough non-thought. But
because boredom can be a powerful thing.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it makes you think about stuff. And I wonder too, to myself, like when I show up at home after an hour long ride with podcasts and then I'm like, oh, now that I'm home, I got to like sit down and unwind for another minute or two. Like I don't come home ready to like roll into social stuff. As you know, Adele.
I do know this and I've stopped listening to podcasts when I go to work and go back from work.
Uh-huh.
I used to listen to podcasts commuting both ways and now I just crave that open space for my mind.
Yeah.
I need it so desperately. And as a teacher and an introvert, I'm constantly trying to make space for solitude for myself because I'm around people all day for my job, constantly interacting. So I've stopped listening to podcasts on my commute. But when I do really long rides, I do find myself sort of escaping into the podcast. Sometimes it's good, but I don't want to do it all the time. For even yesterday, I just made this very conscious, decision to not feed another podcast into my ears and just sort of let my mind be open for a few more hours.
Yeah.
And I think it was healthy, but I don't know, back to you, maybe, yeah, you should try that as an experiment.
I should try
it,
for
sure.
Just
see what happens to your brain when you commute home, perhaps listening to a 20-minute podcast and then letting the other 40 minutes be silence.
Right. Or 20 minutes of a podcast because 20-minute podcasts aren't that great.
Oh, as we all know.
I mean, it depends on what you like. Yeah. David, what would you do if you were me?
I would take out the earbuds.
Yeah.
It scares me on the bike path to see the proliferation of earbuds
right.
on cyclists. Not only because I feel for their thought process, but also for safety reasons.
Mm-hmm. What if you just have it in your right ear?
Well, you know, but well, then you're feeding yourself the voice of another human being. And I can only take so much of that because I enjoy being in my own head.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get that opportunity if I'm listening to another person's voice, even if that voice is rich with information.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can manage the amount of data I'm processing, then that creates more opportunity for me to process that information and engage in reflective thought, which is a bit of a drug.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I did find a good rhythm with, you know, a 10-hour long bike ride. I'll listen to a podcast for an hour, then I'll engage in reflective thought for about an hour or two, and then I'll mull over all those ideas, and then I'll be ready for something new. But if I go back to back to back, new information, I feel like a crazy person after 10 hours. Like, I feel insane.
In one ear, out the other.
Can't do that. Yeah.
As it were.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's also the element that sometimes we don't like being with our own thoughts.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's far more comfortable to ignore what's happening in our own heads and kind of drown that out with something else. So maybe that's the danger of audio.
Yeah. Well, if you solve problems, then hopefully you act on those problems, which means you change your life, and that can be hard.
Right.
I mean, that may sound kind of elitist to say that. I don't know if it is or not, but I like to solve problems. I like to improve and change and make things new and grow just to kind of keep things interesting.
Right. So for those who don't have problems, then that, you know, obviates it all. But most of us do to one extent or another.
Well, yeah. Even if you don't have a sort of a philosophical problem, you could have, I mean, I've processed a lot of like my personal history. I was chuckling to myself yesterday that bicycling is cheaper than therapy because I can process all this stuff, yeah. You know, from my childhood and my adolescence and my 20s. And I just have all this space and my mind will just dredge up all this stuff while I'm bicycling, and I'll kind of work through it and sort of like take different positions and talk to myself in different ways, and I'll kind of work through it. And you've caught me halfway through that sometimes, and I'm in a really weird mood.
Yes.
But then I'll kind of like be like, just give me another few hours and I'll work through it, and then I'll be fine again. And so even if you're not working on like a problem per se, it can be, I don't know, maybe helpful mentally.
Sure.
To just let your mind wander where it will.
Right.
Yeah. Daydreaming is a great vehicle for one's high order thought process. I really encourage students to daydream, to doodle. You know, if what I'm saying is not interesting, think about something that is. As long as you continue to think about something that is interesting and you're engaged.
Yeah. It reminds me of Sven Burkert's wrote the Gutenberg Elegies, and he talked about the importance of reading fiction, because not because of like literacy or anything, but because in reading fiction, your brain is forced to imagine these scenarios that the author describes. And that is an engagement of the mind that we don't get enough of. So yeah. Yeah, we need time for creative thought in all these ways as well. So
in more cycling fiction.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Speaking of which, Aaron still has the copy of what is it? The Pedal Zombies of the post-apocalyptic bicycling stories.
I need to read those.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in, David. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
This is good stuff to chew on.
Yeah, thank you.
Fantastic book. Where can people find your work?
The easiest place is Amazon. So you can go to the Blue Ear Books website also, but Amazon is easy.
Very good. Yeah. And The Descent into Happiness by Dr. David Howell. That's Howell with two L's.
Yeah. So
and
far.
And an E.
Yeah.
Yeah. Should
Thurston
we spell
and
it
Lovey. It's like that.
Look at the title of the podcast. You'll see it there. Very good. So thank you very much. Hope you enjoy your time in town.
Thanks. Yeah.
Hope you enjoy your newfound time with your wife.
Now thank
that
you.
The family is on to independence and such. They'll be back, right?
They'll be back.
Hey, well, this is a completely new phase. Like, now you're officially, it's you're empty nesters.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Dropping off the last kid in college.
This was the day, yeah.
Wow.
And I love
That's
my kids
pretty
to
momentous.
Death. Yeah, but I'm eager to get back to spending time with my wife.
You're ready.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good, because some people aren't, and so that's good to hear.
Yeah. Well, she's straight up amazing.
It's cool.
Fly free, little bird. Fly free. Well, hey, before we close out, we don't have any headlines, but we do have on our calendar.
Calendar.
I like my bike, it's fast. I like my bike, it's fast. It circles around the city.
Okay, a couple of things coming up on this calendar. At first, I want to say this is actually September 24th. I'm going to verify this.
Because isn't today August 24th?
Today is August 24th, and
this could be happening right now.
Friday. I'm pretty sure it's not happening.
Ew.
So let's say September 24th, yes, a month from today as we record this, 6 to 10 p.m., the Portland Hawthorne Hostel, the 13th annual bike-in movie, Rising from Ashes, which is a documentary about the Rwandan cycling team. I think we saw something about this filmed by Bike this year.
We did. The maybe 5 minutes that we saw were really good.
Yeah, yeah. And our friend Sean Granton works over there at the hostel, and so he's inviting everyone from far and wide to come and join. Up next, August 26th. That is 2 days from now in Chicago, filmed by Bike. Thank you, Marcus, for cluing us in. Film by Bike, of course, the film festival here in Portland. It's got little chapters of activity all over the country, so you could go see that in a couple days if you wanted to. August 27th, the Country Swim Ride, meeting at Pip's Donuts. That's 4759 Northeast Fremont here in Portland at 10:30 a.m. Wheels up by 11. This is our friend Josh G.
Those are delicious donuts, by the way.
They are.
Do you remember when we got the free bag of them because we walked there after the blizzard of 2014?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just still remember those donuts. Mm-hmm. So good.
Yeah. Good donuts. And so a Country Swim Ride. This is a ride to swim in the river, if that's your thing.
Which river?
I think there's a few locations
that could affect who wants to swim in one.
It'll be a safe and clean river.
Or the Sandy?
I think it might be the Sandy. I forget now. Just nice. Just offhand. I remember reading the details. But if you're into that. August 28th, produced by Her, a film screening at the Hollywood Theater. This is Women and Bikes, and it's a good thing. 5 p.m. September 10th, the 50 States and 13 Colonies tour in D.C. Tim Mooney told us about this. If you are in Washington, D.C., this is a ride for you. 62 miles or 13 miles. You choose. September 17th, Tour de Brew. You like clean water for people who need it? Do you like beer? These are both good things. Go do that. October 1st, Dr. Something, our friend from Humanity on Wheels and author of the song Beaverton TC. There are not that many transit-focused songs out there, and she does a great job. She is doing a release party for her EP, Rustic Machinery. So that wraps up our headlines. So... anything else we need to throw in there? What should the people know?
What should the people know?
Yes. What are people missing out on if they don't know this? Give me something.
Rolling Rock isn't so bad. I've been drinking it this whole
don't
hour.
Don't discount the cheap beers. David, you're from Milwaukee.
I am.
It's the home of the hipsterest beer
of
in the world.
Cheap beers.
And some very high-end, amazing beers.
And also those, yes.
To go there someday.
Yes.
Drink some good beer.
Oh, totally. And drink some Pabst. What's your relationship like with Pabst?
I love PBR.
Yes.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong.
No,
I love it.
For sure.
Bottle.
Question, do people in Milwaukee call it Pabst or PBR?
PBR.
Okay.
See?
Because in Portland, they had Project Pabst because that's
it must be
what they call it, I guess.
I don't know. The other year, Brock was like, I usually call it Pabst. And I've noticed that it's just maybe it's a cultural thing or which part of the country you're from.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. Like anyways. If you call it soda or pop or something.
Yeah.
Well, I think when you're on your third one, it's easier just to go with initials.
Sure. Sure.
So. And then the ST at the end. How are we supposed to say that?
We don't have a diphthong for that.
Absent. So awkward.
Indeed. All right. Well, let's close this thing out, shall we?
Yeah, I get to read stuff, huh?
You do.
Do I read the bold or the non-bold?
Out hustling. Everybody else.
You read whatever you want. Why don't I start and you follow up with the next line?
I'd love that.
Okay. Sounds good. Our website is thesprocketpodcast.com.
Email to thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com.
Call or text to 503-847-9774.
Twitter at Sprocket Podcast.
Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for our theme music.
Hurt Bird for our headline sounder.
Marcus Norman for graphic design in Chicago.
And thanks to our sustaining donors, Logan Smith, Johnny K., Shadowfoot,
Katharina Mellemgard, Wayne Norman, Doug Robertson,
Ethan Georgie, Justin Martin, Eric Iverson,
Cameron Lane, Richard Wazensky, Tim Mooney,
Orange and Purple, Glenn Kubish, Matt Kelly,
Jim Gooden, Eric Weiss, Dub Cohen Miller,
Todd Parker, Scott McAllister, Morgan, Chris Gonzalez,
Dan Gebhardt, Zoe Capagna, Andy Brunner,
Dave Knows, Chris Smith, Christy Caster,
Caleb Jenkins, and JP Keeley, Peanut Butter Jar, Matt.
Whoa. Patrick R. James, Sebastian Poole, Marco Lowe,
Rich Otterstrom, Andrew Alderson, Drew the Welder,
Anna, Krista, John Wasserman,
Andre Johnson, Shelley and Troy, King of Division,
Josh Zissen, Richard G. Guthrie Straw,
Christopher Barnett, Brandon Shelby, Campsite,
Aaron Green, Mac Nurse David, Catherine Minchin,
Nathan Poulton, Chris Rawson, Rory Close,
Michael Florey, Jeremy Kitchen.
Now brush your teeth
and go to bed.